From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I don't have a sense of being like, leave me alone in my castle and I don't want your opinion. I like the give and take. I like the fight. I'm a Joe. I like the fight.
She's a Joe.
I like the fight, but I like to win, but I like the fight.
When a studio executive suggested that Greta Gerwig change the ending she had devised for her version of Little Women, Gerwig channeled Jo March, the fiery heroine of the Louisa May Alcott classic. Gerwig tells us about rediscovering the 19th century novel in her 30s and finding it surprisingly modern. And she explains why she insisted on writing and directing this film version, even though when she pitched it, before she'd made Lady Bird, she wasn't exactly qualified. But first on the News Banter, America's Got Talent's Got Problems. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my co-banterer, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
Well, so once again, NBC has a mess on its hands. This is not NBC News, which had the whole Ronan Farrow, you know, highly foreseeable debacle of this Ronan Farrow book. Why did they not report the Harvey Weinstein situation? Why did they not report before that the Billy Bush and Donald Trump conversation? What happened with Matt Lauer? All of these questions around NBC News has turned into an ongoing problem. Meanwhile, on the broadcast side, there is now another PR situation, at least. This has started when Gabrielle Union was not renewed as a judge on America's Got Talent after just one year. Her husband, Dwayne Wade, actually tweeted about her saying that she was being fired. He put it that way. She apparently had a series of grievances, including things that seemed to address the culture. For example, it's been reported, and some of this is reported around her. She hasn't necessarily said this directly herself, but it's been reported that she's been told repeatedly that some of her hairstyles were, quote, too black, close quote, whatever that is supposed to mean, that she had asked for offensive jokes that Jay Leno had made to be reported, but that the show did not report it. These were jokes that Jay Leno made as a guest on the show. That she had complained about Simon Cowell, saying he smoked constantly, which is definitely against the rules and makes for a literally toxic environment. There apparently were no doors so that you could at least try to get away from this haze of smoke. And she had apparently had a young black rapper, a 10-year-old that she liked. And allegedly she was told, we need to support these white dancers because America needs to get behind these contestants, whatever version of America. I'm sure NBC and the show's producers at Fremantle have some notion of who their audience is, and maybe they think they're all white, I don't know, or largely white. But all of this has led to NBC now saying that it is going to investigate. Now, with the news division, they investigated themselves, which did not produce great results and certainly bad optics. It's not too clear how they're investigating, but they have had a meeting with Gabrielle Union and her lawyer. And, you know, NBC, this is the kind of PR that NBC doesn't need.
No, I mean, what's the Mad Men quote? Not great, Bob. I mean, this is like all of this stuff. If half of it's true, the optics are horrible. And, you know, if she was let go from the show after complaining about any of this stuff, that's retaliatory. So I think that this is the kind of thing where NBC really has to take this seriously. And the fact that this went public is just adding fuel to the fire and turning this into something that's going to get covered incrementally for every move they make. So they've really got to act carefully here. And it just gets to this question that comes up over and over in these Time's Up Me Too situations. Talent is at the center of this. Simon Cowell is a very, very powerful guy. He created America's Got Talent. He's arguably the biggest star in the unscripted TV universe. And it sounds like he has used his power in a way that is inappropriate. Now, we don't know what actually happened, but that's something that NBC really has to look at.
Yeah, I mean, the former America's Got Talent judge Howard Stern has taken up a cudgel against Simon Cowell, saying he sets it up so that men stay, I'm somewhat paraphrasing, no matter how ugly, no matter how old, no matter how fat, no matter how talentless they are. And then he says, you know, why don't they change Simon? That is the ultimate ultimate example of a boys' club. And I think that is seems to be, I would say, a broader issue, you know, that in these companies, many cases, there is blindness to what would be a boys' club. And we've seen it in other instances. And that is a time's up issue that it really it's very, very difficult to address when the culture is basically shot through with a kind of boys' club mentality where there's not even consciousness that, for example, Howie Mandel has been sitting on this show for years, but Gabrielle Union gets bounced after a year. Meanwhile, let me just pivot to clearly, I would say, the most powerful woman in Hollywood, which is definitely Sherry Redstone. Sherry Redstone has finally completed the merger of Viacom and CBS. This is after multiple attempts and after a big battle to get this done.
Yeah, I mean, she fought Les Moonves over this. She fought her own father over this. I mean, this is only necessary because Sumner Redstone split these companies apart back in 2006. So now comes the bigger challenge. I mean, what does she do next? She's got a company now, Viacom CBS, that has a market cap of about $25 billion. And that's about one-tenth the size of Disney or Comcast, and not to mention some of the digital players here that are really running the show. Does she merge it with another company, say Lionsgate, Sony? Does she try to find a buyer like Apple or Google or one of these others that could really use a content power like that? And what does she do with this collection of a movie studio and broadcast network and cable channels and streaming services like CBS All Access and Pluto TV? Like, there's a nice collection of assets here, but they really do need a strategy when they don't have the strategy that some of these others are going after, which is to create one end-all be-all streaming service like HBO Max or Disney Plus to try to compete with Netflix. They're trying to sell to everybody and they want to be a quote-unquote arms dealer of content for all of the streamers in this new age. Will that work? And is that a long-term play? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see some layoffs. They're going to try and save some money. They're going to try and figure out, I don't know, can they stay small and scrappy? Most analysts, I think they ultimately will need to sell. But more will be revealed. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new film version of Little Women, like the book, tells the story of the four March sisters coming of age in 1860s Massachusetts. With their father away fighting for the Union Army in the Civil War, the family is scraping by in terms of money, but of course they're rich in love. Jo March, played by Saoirse Ronan, is an aspiring writer who early on begins what will become a long friendship, or is it more, with sensitive neighbor boy Laurie, played by Timothée Chalamet.
Jo, would you like to dance with me?
I can't because...
Because of what?
You won't tell?
Never.
I scorched my dress, see? There. And Meg told me to keep still so no one would see it. You can laugh if you want to. It's funny, I know.
I have an idea of how we can manage.
This adaptation of Little Women was written and directed by Greta Gerwig, who was Oscar-nominated for Best Director and Best Original Screenplay for her 2017 film, Lady Bird. The story of Little Women has been catnip to filmmakers. There are movie versions from 1933, 1949, and 1994. Gerwig puts her own spin on the story using a nonlinear approach that jumps forward and backwards in time. For Gerwig, taking on Little Women, a period drama with elaborate sets, costumes, choreography, and music, was a far cry from making the indie, semi-autobiographical Lady Bird. At the same time, she was undergoing a life change.
You were pregnant when you were making this movie.
I was pregnant when I was making this movie, yeah.
Did you tell people? Because I read somewhere that someone, one of your actresses knew you were pregnant because they saw you eating an entire chicken in a day.
No, they didn't. No one knew.
Every day.
They didn't know. In retrospect, they realized I ate an entire chicken in a day. And they were like, God, that, I mean, everybody thought I was just kind of getting chubby on a film set, which it happens. There's so much food around.
Right.
But no one actually knew I was pregnant until later. But it was because, well, at the beginning, you don't tell people because you don't tell people.
Right.
And then there's this kind of
you cross over into the point where you could tell people, but you're like, well, but when is the natural moment to say it? And then, oh, maybe we can just, maybe I'll do this whole thing and no one will know.
Meanwhile, people are wondering, I can't ask her, can I? And like, what if she isn't?
Well, right. So I got to the end of it. And then, but yes, eventually, obviously, it became obvious.
Well, so just rolling back earlier, and obviously the first film that you directed, full on yourself directing in a conventional non-improv mumblecore movie is Lady Bird. But you were thinking about Little Women before that.
I was, yeah.
You were Little Women, huge Little Women fan as a kid.
Huge Little Women fan. Well, I had read the book when I was a kid, and I'd reread it and reread it because I don't know if you were that kind of reader, almost ritualistically rereading things you've already read because it's comforting.
I just kind of swallowed and moved on to the next one.
I listen to music the same way. I'll listen to a song, you know, 150 times and then I can't do it anymore. And I would reread books, and Little Women was one of the books that I reread a lot. And it was, for so many reasons, that Jo March was my character. She was angry and she was ambitious and she wanted to be a writer and she felt like she didn't fit in. There were so many things about her that I felt were in me. And then I think the last time I read it, I must have been like 14. And then I didn't read it after that. And then I reread it when I was 30. And I was completely shocked by how modern and strange and spiky and necessary it felt when I was reading it. And I thought, oh my God, was this always in this book? I felt like I hadn't remembered it. I felt like I hadn't even read it, which seems impossible because those girls, those stories, those moments, their adventures were so inside of me. But particularly the part when they were adults was just fascinating and totally had not remembered it at all. And at that point, I had written two films with Noah, and I produced those as well as acted in them. And I knew I was, at that point, I was definitely saying out loud to myself and to my friends that I wanted to be a director. But I thought, oh, I'd love to write this and I'd love to direct it. But I didn't really know if there was a way to do that. But then I heard that Amy Pascal and Tony were interested in making another Little Women because it had been, you know, 21 years at that point since the 1994 version. So I said, I got to get in that room. And then...
But where is Lady Bird at that point?
I had written Lady Bird, but I hadn't made it yet. So they got me in the room and I explained what I thought the film was should be about, what I thought the book was about.
But Amy was still at Sony as chairman at that point, wasn't she?
Well, it was 2015 going into 2016.
Maybe not.
So that was after, because I have a draft of my on my computer from 2015 that I had started working on, and then 2016, and then I...
This is Little Women.
Yeah, and then I wrote a couple of drafts, and then I went into pre-production for Lady Bird. So then I went away and I made Lady Bird and then it came out. And then that's when they came back and said, would you like to direct it? Which I did.
So initially you were going to write it but not direct it?
Well, I always knew I was going to direct it, but they didn't know. So they came around to the idea that I was going to direct it. But I didn't have any qualifications yet.
Right, you hadn't made Lady Bird.
No, I had made Lady Bird. And it was going, no matter what, it was going to be a big project. You know, it's a big period piece with a lot of characters over many years. It's an unwieldy thing. And they're
amazing costumes.
Amazing costumes. And it's not something that you would hand to someone who had never directed.
Right. That would be scary to do.
Yeah. So.
And probably not great for you in a way.
Right? Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was definitely a much bigger production and a much larger canvas than I had worked on in Lady Bird. But I didn't go from a $5 million movie to a $120 million movie. So it was still within the realm of, you know, it's a bigger step.
It's a
progression. Mm-hmm. I actually read an interview that Ridley Scott did about learning how to make films and deal with bigger productions. And he said he saw a lot, you know, people getting thrown into the deep end.
We've seen it happen.
And he's like, and you really should try to, if you're a director, as much as you can, take steps up. If you're interested in making bigger films, you shouldn't necessarily just, you know, die. Although sometimes it works, but I
mean, yes, occasionally, but boy, we've seen some careers get hurt badly by this. You
right.
know?
And so I was cognizant of wanting to be mindful of a career that I was trying to look at as a director of trying to get better bit by bit.
Right, build it.
To build it. And to know that, you know, where you are going to be in your 10th film is not where you are on your second film. And that's okay. So anyway, after Lady Bird, then they said, would you like to direct it? And I was thrilled. And I was like, I've been waiting for 30 years for someone to ask me to direct this
so
movie.
So they asked you, because I thought you had told Amy, like, it has to be me. You to do it.
I did. I had said, it has to be me. I have to do it. But that was, again, that was before. So it was before
was
Lady
like,
Bird. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were like that sure. crazy girl just came in off the street and said, I have to direct this.
So were you surprised by the commercial success of Lady Bird?
Yes. It was amazing. It was astonishing. It was deeply meaningful also because it was a movie about a mother and a daughter and Sacramento. And it was intimate. And it was something that I hadn't anticipated it. And it was incredibly moving to me. It continues to be incredibly moving to me. And it's very sweet when girls on the street said, I saw it with my mom.
I said that to you when I met you. I saw it with my daughter.
I know, it just kills me.
We were laughing and crying.
It kills me because, I mean, that's why I make movies, hopefully, that they reach the people for whom it would make them feel. And so, yeah, it was amazing. And it was amazing because it enabled me to keep going and it enabled me to become a candidate to direct something like this.
So Saoirse obviously was in that movie, Saoirse Ronan, and did you always think this is my Joe?
actually, she told me she was going to play Joe.
Oh, she did. She told you that when we were making Lady Bird, or did she know it was cooking?
She knew it was. She did not know it was cooking during Lady Bird. She knew it was cooking when Lady Bird was coming out, and we were actually at the Independent Spirit Awards, and she told me, "I know you're making Little Women, and I am going to play Joe." At that point, I had a script, but I knew I needed to rewrite it. And because I knew that I was going to ground the story in the women as adults, I wasn't sure what age I was going to center everyone in, whether people were playing up or down or how I was going to do it. So I had Saoirse and Timmy in my mind, but I wasn't positive yet how it was all going to shake down. And in any case, then when she said, I'll be playing Joe, I realized she was correct. And then it was like saying, that's a chair. And you're like, oh, you're right. That is a chair. You're Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And also it was a very Joe thing for her to do. And both of us later, we talked about, she told me she's never done anything like that before. She's never said, I want this as an actor. And I'd never done that before as a writer director. I'd never gone in and said, I've got to do this. So we felt mutually that Louisa May Alcott / Joe March was somehow speaking through us.
The agency of Joe.
Yeah, Joe wants things.
And she goes for it.
That's right.
Coming up after a short break, Greta Gerwig tells us about finding herself in the awards race at the same time as her partner, Marriage Story director Noah Baumbach. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Greta Gerwig, writer and director of Little Women, which will be in theaters starting Christmas Day. Set in the 1860s, Little Women follows four penniless sisters, Meg, Beth, Amy, and our heroine, Jo, played by Saoirse Ronan. Jo is a stubborn, aspiring writer who refuses to settle for what she believes would be a very unhappy life as a New England housewife. As a young girl, Jo earns a little money from reading to her great aunt March, played by Meryl Streep.
You mind yourself, dearie. Someday you'll need me, and you'll wish you had behaved better.
Thank you, Aunt March, for your employment and your many kindnesses, but I intend to make my own way in the world.
Oh, well, No, no one makes their own way. Not really. Least of all a woman. You'll need to marry well.
But you are not married, Aunt March.
Well, that's because I'm rich.
Gerwig's version of Little Women moves back and forth in time, following the sisters as young adults and as teens. You start out with the adults, because as I've heard you say, that you thought adults were more interesting than girls.
Well, I think the girls are incredibly interesting, but I think that what I was struck by was what their relationship is to their own magical childhood, in a way, and this kind of shared nostalgia with the audience for girlhood. Mm. And what I realized when I reread the book as an adult was, once they're all in their separate lives, as Joe's in New York trying to be a writer, Beth is living in the childhood home, but she's alone and she's dealing with her health. Meg is with her children in her marital home, dealing with two small kids and money troubles. And Amy's in Europe trying to be a painter. Once they're all separated, they never are actually going to all be together again. That what that thing that we loved is already gone. And that, when I realized that, killed me. And then I thought, well, what if the thing that they're all yearning for as adults then becomes the thing that, as an audience, when we see them all together, we feel like, oh, right, you're all together, and then it's gone. And then also this kind of, this big, brave, ambitious girlhood that as adults, it becomes more difficult to maintain that level of ambition and hopefulness and idealism. And what do you do with that? And how do you honor that? And in any case, that was, I love girlhood just as much as anyone. And I love that about the novel. But once I realized that structurally, that it never comes again, that was something that I wanted to bring out in this telling of this funky, funky timelines.
Yes, well, you definitely switch back and forth a lot. Mm-hmm. Did you always conceive of doing it, cutting back and forth in time?
It was always the way it was conceived, and it was on the page that way. Time is always moving forward. There's two separate timelines that start from two different origin points, but everything's moving forward. So you have one starting in 1861 and one starting in 1868. And they're speaking to each other, and they're commenting on each other, and the past and the future are intertwined in a way that's how I experience time. I experience, when I walk down the street, it's not just me walking down the street as 36-year-old me. It's me thinking of all the times I've been in Santa Monica and the last time it rained and where my friend is who's pregnant, who lives over there, and what she was doing the first time she moved here. Like, I feel like there's always a symphony of memory and meaning that you're accruing throughout your life, and that by the time you reach a certain age, there's enough to look back at. And I wanted it to feel like the movie from beginning to end almost functioned as a palindrome. And I wanted to do that musically and cinematically and with the language, but visually, so that at the beginning, and this doesn't spoil anything, it starts on her back, and at the end you're on her face, and that I wanted it to feel like it was a record that you could pick up the needle and put it on again and it would play the same way. And I had this sense that there would be a great deal of emotion in always knowing what is already gone, because movies, cinema can do a thing that no other art form can do, is that it's a time machine, and it can create the thing that's already past, can live in front of you in its fullness. And so I wanted to use all those tools.
And at one point, another thing I read, somebody was like, and I'm trying to figure out how to do this without giving away what you did. You did something very creative with the ending. Somebody suggested a different, maybe blander, let's say, a different thing than what you did.
Sure.
And I have an idea who that somebody might be. I'm dying to just say it was him, wasn't it? I noticed that when you guys have talked about it, you or Amy Pascal, you always go, somebody. No. But when that happened, yes. You know, let's just make an assumption that it's the studio. And I'll just note for listeners, that's a studio where the person who runs it likes to control things and be involved in details. What happens when somebody wants that?
Well, what I'll say is, I mean, it, you know, it,
is it just no?
No, no. It's what's wonderful is actually, I will say at the outset, this is exactly the film I want it to be from beginning to end. So all of the discussions of what the film should be ended up exactly where I wanted them,
right.
Which is wonderful. But I have to say, you know, how I start the film with Jo March talking to her publisher, Mr. Dashwood. And
which is funny because I'm a Jane Austen fan and that's the Sense and Sensibility.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yes,
isn't that
Eleanor's just, name I know, is Dashwood.
But. I know. She knew that too,
right.
Which is
I'm sure
wonderful.
She did. Yes.
But Jo March, and it's almost word for word taken from the book, is trying to figure out how to sell a story. And she's pretending that it's not hers, even though it is hers. But some of the lines are just, they could have been written yesterday. Mr. Dashwood is saying, morals don't sell nowadays. People like to be amused, not preached at. And he's asking her to alter her story. And she's figuring out, how much can I alter my story and still sell it? And I just remember I underlined this entire section. I dog-eared it. And I was like, are you kidding me? This is wonderful. This is this wonderful interaction between her and somebody who has the ability to publish her art. And I felt like it could have been me yesterday talking to someone who's going to make a movie. And I think for me, I've always gotten a kick out of that process, of that discussion and that negotiation, and that process with a studio, with an audience, with how far can you push it, how far can you pull back. Like, it's great, it's fun, it's like, it's the showbiz of movies,
right.
And I think that for me is fun. So I don't have a sense of being like, leave me alone in my castle and I don't want your opinion. I like the give and take. I like the fight. I'm a Joe. I like the fight. I like the fight. But I like to win, but I like the fight.
Well, I'm sure you get sick of being asked about being in a relationship with another filmmaker. And this is a filmmaker who now has got an awards movie. You must have a ready answer for that one. So you can just.
You know what? I don't.
You don't
know. I know. I should have some sort of
Laura Dern
statement.
Versus Laura Dern.
I
She's
know.
In both movies. Like,
I know.
You don't have a statement?
I don't have a statement.
Do you guys just be like, okay, so good luck with your movie?
Oh, no. I mean, obviously I've written with Noah. I've made movies with Noah. I show him cuts. I have him read drafts. I look at what he's working on. I don't know. I think it's interesting. I was actually talking to Mike Mills and Miranda July, who are also both filmmakers, and they stay separate. And it's just an interesting different ways of going about it. But I think it's so useful to have somebody who just can be Noah's my favorite writer. It's my favorite filmmaker. To have another set of eyes to look at what you're doing and if they think it's working. I mean, he's the hardest laugh, I will say. So I feel like if I can get a laugh from him, then it's probably funny.
Right.
I don't have a ready answer. The Laura Dern in both of our films is truly coincidental, but I've loved Laura since I knew about Laura. The time I fell in love with Laura was when I saw Citizen Ruth. I felt like I'd never seen acting like that. But anyway, I just loved her, and I'd always had a dream of working with her. So this had come along, and we just happened to be at the same time. But
now but now you and Noah are campaigning at the same time. That's kind of funny.
mostly it's funny when we're like ships that pass in the night. Like, he's gonna go do something that I just did, or vice versa.
Who knows? He may rotate through here any minute.
And then, it's just odd. I mean, also. It's hard to make movies, and it's hard to make a good movie. And then beyond that, it's amazing when it gets recognized. So I think for both of us, it's just sort of like, this moment will never come again, and how amazing is this?
Greta Gerwig is the writer and director of Little Women in theaters Christmas Day. Thank you for joining
us. Thank
you.
Thanks so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.